We're going to start off. Last week, we talked about making your main ideas punchy, picking something, the dominant thing that you want to communicate, and doing it in such a way that it actually grabs and sticks with your students. This week, we're talking about how to make your main thoughts more actionable. As I was thinking about a lot of student Bible teachings that I've sat through, the more I considered this, I would say that I think this might be the biggest weakness that I perceive in some of our teachings is people will lay all of this bedrock, do great exposition, treat the passage really well, even bring some focus, some heat, emphasize important ideas, and then wrap up a teaching without actually making it actionable in a way that's going to stick with students. This is laying on what we call the working memory. This is kind of the big, in the field of teaching and learning, the big thing that people think about is how do you bring ideas into people's, what they call working memory, the part of our brain that grabs stuff I've learned before and then does something with it. He says, we have more than 100 years of research demonstrating that engaging in retrieval practice activities that require us to draw newly learned material from our memories has significant benefits for our long-term learning. Lessons that are retrieved, drawn back into our working memory, and put into practice are the ones that actually stick with us. This is Sousa and what's going on in the brain there. In recent years, researchers have compiled studies suggesting that the functioning of working memory can be explained by a three-part system containing a central control mechanism and two subordinate components involved in rehearsal. So when this is happening in our brain, when our brains are actually codifying something and saying, this is a thing that I want to and I'm going to remember, there's kind of like three things going on. There's a controlling part of our brain that's pulling on two different ideas. This is how Sousa decides to describe it. One of them's the phonological loop and the other's the visual spatial sketch pad. Reading some of these guys, Seuss is like, he's a genius, obviously. But I think that they try to come up with words like this just to, it's their way of trying to make you feel little, make them feel. Put in simple terms, when my brain really grabs hold of something and decides I want to keep this information, phonological loop, that's me both hearing and talking about the idea, so discussing with other people, kicking it around, and the goddamn visual spatial sketch pad, all that means is imagination. Imagining, thinking about what it might actually look like for me to put this idea into practice. Those are the two things that happen in a moment where our brains really grab something. So yeah, the WOTC loop is the mechanism that uses auditory signals to code information into working memory, such as when we're talking about what we're learning. The WOTC sketchpad allows for encoding information into working memory by envisioning in the mind's eye how one might put the information into practice in the near future. Yeah, so an important difference between a classroom setting is you're trying to teach students something in a classroom. You might present ideas, get them to talk about it, and then have them sit down and do some work, solve some problems. And that's kind of how they remember. In doing Bible teachings, when we offer up application, it's almost always things that are in the future. And this is an issue because it forces us to craft our application in such a way that they can actually envision in their mind's eye, this is what I could do with this in the near future, and this is why I'm going to remember it. So this three-part model suggests that auditory and visual rehearsal occurring during learning increases working memory's interactions with long-term memory, raising the probability it will be stored. So basically, they do these studies where they're imaging people's brains as they're listening to stuff, and they see that for people that both think and talk about whatever it is that they're interacting with and then envision what it's going to look like for them to do something with it, though that's information that ends up getting retained. So in a Bible teaching, I think this looks like getting your students talking about, discussing during the teaching, the dominant application. Yeah, we've talked about the value of discussion questions for helping students to focus. I would say this, I will always, every single time, in a home church setting, I will always use one of my discussion questions to get people thinking about and imagining whatever the main application idea is. Every single time, that's going to be one of my questions. It's getting the big thing that I hope that students do with this teaching to be something their brains are processing on a deeper level. And finally, we're going to talk about how to draw application that they can actually envision and put into action in the near future. So, thoughts on improving our application. We'll get you 92% of the way to a good teaching. Here we go. It's not all the way. It's almost there. It really doesn't matter. You could be god-awful boring. You could be just about the most uninteresting human being on the planet. That's fine. You can give really good Bible teachings and get you 92% of the way there. Just get through the passage without being shockingly boring. Work through it with a little bit of interest. We've talked about a lot of strategies for do that. Present a punchy idea, a thing that you hope that sticks, and then just get your students to talk about how does God want us to act in light of that. It's not rocket science. I mean, truly, if you can just do a couple of things, bring one thing from the text to light that the students can grapple with, and then have them talk about what is it that I'm going to do with this, I'm almost there. I think case study discussion questions are extremely effective for students right now, increasingly as the years go on. I'm basically asking one of these every single teaching. A case study enables your... It's great. They're great. On the one hand, you can make a case study really funny. Really funny. You know, you can be really pointed. So like, if you ask your students, like, what are you going to do about your porn problem? They have a hard time. But if you ask them, like, you come up with a funny name, you know, Jimmy says, so comes to you and admits, like, yeah, I'm having a hard time. I'm feeling some conviction. I'm having a hard time with porn, but I'm not really sure what I'm going to do. Dispersing it onto another person, a fake imaginary person in the mind, there's some safety there. It's not me. It's another person. But I also know it is me at the same time. Yeah, there's something about this that invites them to really think about what could it look like for me to be in this situation? I'm asking these all the time right now. And it's easier for them to envision if I'm the listener or the respondent, what am I going to do in this situation? I like both of those questions. A couple ideas on application. First off, what it is not. Application is not if when you construct your application, if it's a thought or an idea, you have not come up with an application. That is not an application point. Application is not theological propositions. It's not truths. It's not warnings. It's not your antithesis. It's not things they should avoid. It's not changes to thinking. This is a key idea. I mean, something that our fellowship is really strong on is a solid biblical model for change, right? Reorienting, reintroducing new ways of thinking. That's great. We're going to do that in our teachings. A major problem I find is that in so much of the application that I hear people give in teachings, they're just describing moving along the change model. And the problem is you're just talking through thoughts. How they're actually going to move along the change model is they need to do things with the thoughts. Yes, you need to teach the theological propositions that are going to help them to get under the surface and figure out some of this stuff. But people will basically get up and say, all right, so how do we apply this teaching? And they'll just talk about propositions of the change model. That's not actually something the students will ever do with the teaching. They're not going to do anything with that. And ultimately, their thinking's not going to be changed. Yeah. Give you some examples. Someone teaches through this block in Romans 5. So good, so powerful. Christ dying for the ungodly, demonstrating his love for us. It's great. I can't tell you how many times I'll see someone teach this, and the application that they draw from this is we've just got to be more grateful. We've got to be more thankful. All right, so let's wrap it up. How should we apply this lesson? We need to be more thankful in our lives. I've heard this a billion times. It's true. This might be, if my punch in this teaching, it might be something related to gratitude for the cross. That's totally true. This is not an application. This is an idea. This is the boo, the tweet, tweety little birds floating around in the nethersphere. It doesn't mean anything to them. You tell your students they should be more thankful. That doesn't, you're speaking Mandarin. Like that, they can't do anything with you telling them you should be more thankful. Yeah. I will propositionally introduce this. I'll create some tension on how their lives are going to have, their faith is going to be wrecked if they don't have gratitude. But this is not a thing for them to do that's actually going to codify, that's actually going to help them to learn this information. 1 Corinthians 6, fleeing from sexual immorality, all their sins against the body, whatever. Okay, here people teach this and they're like, all right, so you got to realize the damage that porn's doing to you. You got to realize that. This is not an application. That's what your teaching is supposed to do, is to help them to realize that. And now you're telling them to do the teaching that you just gave them. The hope is they do realize it in this moment. But if you fail to actually give them something to do in light of that, yeah, this is where the real learning happens. We know this. Faith acted out in love. This is how the Spirit actually has the opportunity to introduce some work into our lives. You're doing so much work to give an excellent Bible teaching. You get 98% of the way there, and then you're not giving them something to do that's going to enable them to experientially, as the Spirit lives out their act of faith, cement this thing into their mind. Choose to agree with God's view of sex. Propositions. Choose. This is maybe getting closer. You're calling on them to make some kind of a decision, but it's still not a thing that they can do. You could alter this and say, why don't you talk to God right now? Why don't you call out in your heart and say, God, I want to agree with you. This is hard, but I want to make this a part of my life. I want to agree with you on this. Now all of a sudden I have made an application point. When I say choose to agree with God's view of sex, I'm speaking Mandarin in the nethersphere, and it's not going to do anything. But those two thoughts are so close. Choose to agree with God's view of sex. Talk to God in your heart right now, or before you go to sleep tonight or something, and tell God, I want to stick with you on this. Those two thoughts are so close, but the difference is a chasm. And the difference is whether or not they may actually end up agreeing with God's view of sex. They may in that moment really feel like, yeah, this is a powerful teaching. This is interesting. But if they actually had a moment where they talked to God and they could remember that time I told God, I think I want to agree with you on this. Now you actually might have changed their life with your Bible teaching. The difference is huge. So, how do we do this? We have to make our application points actionable in the way that we frame them. That means that the way that I say it, I give you guys that Stott reading. One of my favorite things in that reading is Stott talks about the power of words and leveraging the right words to make your points. Application, I think, is where this happens. Boy, honestly, I think part of the problem for people sometimes with application is, frankly, mental laziness. It's really hard to come up with good application. There's teachings where it feels easy, but a lot of teachings, it's really hard to figure out how can I give them something to do that they can actually act on in the near future. There's teachings where I will spend hours pouring over in my mind, how can I actually frame this in a way that they can do something with it? You know that you've come up with good, actionable application if the application points that you made guide the kind of follow-up that your leadership team does the rest of the night. You've given your co-leaders very specific things that they can talk to the students, they can do with the students. It should actually, this should be the blueprint for the way that your leadership team operates the rest of the night based on the application you give. We're going to go through some examples of that. It should be short term, and I would argue extremely, very short term. Sousa, they map out that people's working memory, how long an idea is held in this part of my brain that wants to rip it apart and do something with it and actually learn it. You got about 24 to 48 hours before it hits peak decay, before it's probably gone. And so you could come up with an application that's like, man, you've got camp coming up with a month. That's going to be a great opportunity for you to build some friendships. I like that. I mean, that's a good application. Hopeless. Absolutely hopeless. It's gone. It's in a different universe by the time you get a month from now. Yeah, I really think with students, you should be trying to think of things immediately. Tonight, maybe tomorrow, God forbid, maybe if you're teaching on a Sunday night, you might give them something they could do by Tuesday. Varied. This is where you come up with variation of the capacities or needs of your students, because for application, you can pitch things that hit people at very different places. And this is important. The message of the text has to be what it is, and you have to start by studying it. Let me think of how I want to put this. The wrong approach here, when you get dealt a section of text to preach, is what do I want my students to start doing? What's my application? And then how do I come back and construct a teaching that's going to build to that? That's a recipe for making a terrible teaching, a teaching where you're steer wrestling the passage into what you want to say. And when you do that, the Spirit's not going to... You say God's not going to honor that, or the Spirit won't. Well, the reason is you're not going to be able to throw the right kind of punch from the text where the students can see, here it's obviously telling me this, and now I understand that, and that informs why I'm going to act out and do this thing. So be very careful of that. It's not that you start with your applying ideas, but after I've really sat with the text and I really understand this is what's going on, this is what God intends, this is where I can, and that should be what it is. If it speaks to non-believers, then I should give a teaching that by and large speaks to non-believers. If it speaks to believers struggling with sin, then I should give a teaching that speaks to believers struggling with sin. But then it's at this moment where I bridge out into application that all of a sudden I can start speaking to different people in the room. And you should do this in your application. It should be pointed. You should try to come up with specific words and language that are sharp, that might be kind of awkward, kind of offensive. Maybe there'll be some awkward laughs when you say it. That is really not a bad thing. That means they've actually listened to whatever you've just said. This is where you can relate it to the tensions that you came up with earlier. Yeah, we talked about this important tension. So what are we going to do based on that? We'll look at some examples, but you want to come up with words that are going to make the idea more emphatic, something that their brains are more interested in. Is this something that I would actually go out and do? So let's go through some examples with these specific texts. Romans 5. Yeah, I preached this passage. A couple different applications I might draw. If you're not saved yet, why don't you go home tonight? This is where I would bring, you know, one of the tensions that I might bring up is, could this possibly be true, that God would die for the ungodly? Is it even conceivable? I would hit him with a form of Pascal's wager. If you haven't done this yet, come on. Like, you at least need to figure out if there's anything to this, because this is the greatest story ever told. There's the tension. But now I'm going to go one step further, and I'm going to frame it in a way that they actually might do something with it. Why don't you go home tonight and write out a list? You're not sure what you think about this, but write out a list about whether or not it would be worth it to make this decision. I don't know if it's possible. I would be shocked if someone did that and didn't end up coming to faith. I mean, that's a level of mental, emotional engagement. I know that the Spirit would meet them in that moment. I feel sure of that. But it's going one step further. You know, Pascal's wager, that's not an application idea. If you say something like, you got to think about whether or not this is possible, that's good. You're close. But you go a step further and you make it more actionable. You tie it to something in the short term, and now they might actually do it. Pick a verse, or maybe you point it out to them. Verse 6, you see, at just the right time, when we are still powerless, Christ died for the ungodly. Pick a verse on Jesus' grace. So you want them to be more grateful. That's the idea I'm introducing. What can they do with that? Why don't you pick a verse about how amazing God's grace is, and try to memorize it with someone on the ride home. Verse 6, it's easy. Why don't you just pull? And here I've coded for my leaders. Now on the ride home, I'm shooting around with the students, like, all right, what do you got? You got the first four words? You got the next three words? Blah, blah, blah. I've laid a blueprint for things my leaders can do the rest of the night. Now maybe, just maybe, and then that leader picks that student up 2 weeks later. You still got Romans 5, verse 6? You still got it? Nah, yeah, yeah. I want this student to be more grateful. Now what about if I can help them to code in their mind at just the right time? Christ died for the ungodly. That's actually getting them a step further. Why don't you pray on the ride home? Why don't you guys get together and you pray for a friend that you want to invite out when you get to school on Monday? So tension, or maybe the punch that I would throw in this passage to my cell group, to my home church. This is the greatest story ever told. And you've got, what's that, Bubba? You've got it. You know, you've got it right there in your hands. The greatest truth in the history of the world, you have it. And how could you have the audacity to not go out and hand that to other people? That's a great, that's good preaching. That's awesome. Make it actionable. Yeah, if you're feeling moved by this, why don't you do this on Monday? Why don't you find somebody you could invite out to home church or CT so they can hear that gospel? And then a step further, why don't you guys pray in the car ride home together? I'm thinking about talking to this guy. Let's pray for him. Again, you've given your co-leader stuff to do throughout the night. 1 Corinthians 6 on sex. Yeah, we talked about porn's going to be damaging. Step further. Why don't you open up to someone tonight? Here's where we're going to use some pointed language. I could say, if you're struggling with something, why don't you share it with someone? I could say that. If you're struggling with something, why don't you share it with someone? But that's kind of the fluffy Care Bear style of the point. Instead, I picked these words pretty specifically. If you got a hidden sin that you've been nursing, they might not even know what the phrase nursing something, they might not know what it means, but it's nursing and sex and it's weird and they might laugh. They might be like, what the hell? But it's a little more like, if you got something you're hiding, why don't you do something about it tonight? Why don't you talk to someone? If you're struggling with porn, why don't you put a reminder in your phone right now to look back at these verses every day this week and just pray when you do it. God, help me to believe these things. Help me to trust you here. Yeah, your students are always pulling their phones out and you're pissed at them for it. Ah, leverage it against them. Your phone's already out. Why don't you just pop this in your phone? Just read those verses every day this week. Why don't you ask a leader tonight, what's their story in this area? What's God shown them? Taught them about trusting him in the area of sex. Why don't you ask one of your leaders tonight? Blueprint, you've made it so easy for your co-leaders to talk to the students the whole rest of the night. On any given leadership team, you've got multiple co-leaders that have a story about trusting God in the area of sex that would knock people dead, that is powerful. And if you frame your application in this way, you're lining up that shot, you're stuffing the cannon, you're giving them a chance to actually do something with the lives that God's given them. You see how much better this is than saying, why don't you open up with someone later tonight? Why don't you talk about this area of your life? Ask one of the leaders about their stories. They probably got some wild stories. Why don't you ask them? It's more pointed. It's more gripping. Maybe right now you're feeling like some tension. Maybe you feel a little uncomfortable, uncertain. I'll tell you what. It's possible that that's God's enemy. That Satan is coming after you right now and right in this moment. He's trying to get you to hide some conviction, some sin. Why don't you grab someone right after the teaching and let them know you're feeling that way? Why don't you talk to them? Why don't you pray with them? Yeah. These are far better. Far more likely that they're actually going to bring this into their working memory. All right, let's do an exercise. 2 Corinthians 1. God of all comfort. Grab two or three people around you and try to come up with maybe three or four different application points and try to vary them to the needs of non-believer, people at different points in your group. Let's spend a couple minutes on that. Let's hear what we got. Something bold. Let's go. Yeah. Ask someone on the car ride home how you can pray for their struggles. Yeah, I like it. One of the ways you could relate that to attention is you could point out, I like pointing out to people, you've got real sufferings and pains, and you know the ways, people just don't know that. They're not in your head. That's true of every guy in this room with you here tonight. There's guys that are hurting. Why don't you ask some of your buddies on the ride home if there's something you can pray for them? I like that. Yeah, I think it's good. Yep. Yeah.
So I think ask a leader or someone who is a believer how they've experienced God.
I think that's excellent. Yeah, you might be skeptical. You may not have felt like God is a comforting God. You might actually have this perception that he's distant, unfeeling. Yeah, are you willing to hear someone out? Why don't you ask someone tonight if they got a story about a time that God really comforted them? I think that's excellent, excellent application. Yep. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's good. Part of what that would probably involve is calling on them. If you got an area of struggle, strife, it's time you share it. God wants to be these things for you, but he probably can't until you actually get it out there. So why don't you try that? Why don't you ask someone if they know anything in the Word that relates to this? Yeah, I think it's good. Yep. Yeah. I've never done that. That's interesting. Yeah, you got a specific struggle. Why don't you Google it? The verses, blah, blah. That's interesting. I never thought about that. Yeah.
You also said, in terms of comforting your friend, like texting a friend who's having a hard time, like thinking about you, or we hang out soon, something like that. Like, it's very actionable. They're not going to remember.
Yeah. I like that. You're teaching to like a group of middle school guys or something, high school guys. How crazy would it be if you, there's got to be some small ways you could show the guys you care about that you care about them, you're there. If one of your boys goes through something, shoot them a text. Yeah, I like that. That's cool. Yeah. If you give this teaching and you get your co-leaders are able to, they take a couple kids home and the whole time they're giving some testimonies. That's great. You've probably done a lot more in that night than in most teachings. It's good. Yeah. Anybody have a different idea? Anybody have a thought for somebody who's not a believer that came up? Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I like that a lot. You know, how many people have you heard their testimony and they share that at the moment they came to faith, they felt this just blanket of peace drop on them? Yeah. How about sharing that with your students? A lot of people have this experience. There is a tangible peace out there that God wants for you, and you got to make this decision to experience that. I like that. I think that's good. Yeah, those are good. I guess what I would emphasize is work on application. Workshop. Sometimes it feels obvious these are the kind of couple of main desires I would have for how students would act this out. to come up with these, like to come up with those six examples I gave you guys, I probably spent like an hour and a half. I wrote stuff out. I changed them probably half a dozen times. I felt pushed by God that I need to work harder on my application of my CTs. I looked back on my last couple teachings and I was like fluffy, airy, Care Bear, not specific. Yeah. Yeah.
Ask a leader about something in the car ride home. Like, there are certain things that I think we can, like, pull out of this that are templates almost in a sense.
Yeah.
That you can use for so many different questions.
Yeah, and I think it's good to come up with a backlog of some of these, like, immediacy points. But I think some of it comes from just there. I think this text is actually easier. There's a lot of texts where it's harder, you know. You get dealt a section of narrative and judges, and it's like, well, you know, it might not seem immediate. And so maybe ultimately the punch that you end up wanting to throw is something related to faith that's more bone deep intellectual than just emotional, experiential. You feel like that's what you want to present to your students, but then how do I get to what they can actually do based on this teaching? It can be harder. And so I would just say that I would work hard. And I would also remember with some of the points that we made earlier that you probably have them the least at the very end of the teaching. And so if at all humanly possible, do not do application at the end of your teaching. Instead, what I'm trying to do at this point is I'm basically trying to, I want my teaching to feel more like like a up-down of moments where I'm emphasizing more, moments where it's more conversational, we're just talking, and more emphasis. And I'm trying to make it so that like 5 minutes in, 10 minutes in, 15 minutes in, I'm bringing up attention, I'm bringing up a theological idea, and then I'm giving them something that they could do with it. A list is terrible. A list is terrible. A list is telling them this is going to be long, so don't listen. If you happen to use PowerPoint in anything that you do, I think a list is the worst conceivable thing that you could do. All it's telling students is this is going to be long, and I shouldn't listen. I would rather vary application with when the points are coming up in a teaching. If it's a kind of teaching like a narrative where I have to just build the ideas in the end, then what we're going to go through next I think is important. You probably need to think about with students, how can I just get through this text faster and expositing the text faster? Because like we talked about, they've only got so much. Their resources of mental energy, there's only so much, and if you wait till the end, they're probably missing it. This is also where application discussion questions are good, because that's a moment of reinvigorating, drawing them back in. Okay, progressing through the text. I tried to make this as concrete as I could, but it was really hard. This is based on just a amorphous sense that I have as I listen to people teach to students that a big difference, I think, between teaching to adults or people in your college group is that you can move through a block of text and deal equal weight to different ideas and have, you know, discussion throughout and treat different ideas, you know, with some pace. You can talk about more things, and people are going to stay with you. I think that with students, you really only have so much time where you can exposit the text with them, where they're actually with you. And you have to be able to move with pace to the ideas that you want to emphasize the most. So a couple of thoughts on this. And kind of what I'm getting at is how can we do this without just rushing or failing to actually exposit the text well? It's really hard to pin down. My suggestion here is go faster, be better. And I'll elaborate on what I mean. Go faster, be better. And that you have to lead. You have to lead the way that they read the text. I think this is amplified now, and it is going to increasingly be... we already had a problem with the IT revolution and students' capacity to read and read thoughtfully and well. And then COVID really significantly affected this. This is Gazalian Rosen on the way that we tend to read today. Rather than our eyes passing from word to word along each successive line of text, we tend to read in an F pattern. We start at the top left. We do a little bit of foraying into the middle. We don't read the page line by line, but our brain kind of takes in the whole thing at once and makes some snap assumptions. Do I actually care about this? Yeah, this is the big thing that tech is kind of doing to our brains. We're so used to viewing a thing as a screen, and this intermittent reinforcement we talked about, our brains are so good at looking at a screen and assessing, is the information I want here? Is this going to be interesting? Is this going to be valuable? This is a phenomenon of like you're trying to find a recipe, trying to find a cashew chicken recipe. You pull up a page, and your brain does a thing in the first 0.1 second where it's like, is this good or bad? And you don't even know how you did it. You maybe looked at the title. Your brain also took in 4.2 stars. That's pretty low. Your brain also took in, I don't see a jump to recipe button. And immediately you're out of it before you even know it. You just did it so fast. We do that in how we read as well. They found this F pattern thing by imaging people's eyes as they had them reading pages, where students would flip a page in their textbook and they wouldn't just start reading at the top, but they would jump to keywords in the middle and the ends and whatever. The point is that if you sit down and you read five verses with your students and you assume that they took in a single word on the page, you've made a grave and terrible assumption. COVID. One study found this. Huge study. 5 million students or something. 5 million U.S. students, grades 3 through 8. Initial evidence from students in K-2 tested during the pandemic indicates that a significantly higher proportion of the students are at risk for reading problems compared to pre-COVID-19 students. Students of color attending high-poverty elementary schools saw the largest test score declines in reading. They're finding students are 1, 2, 3 grades further behind than they ought to be at this point. This problem is going to be magnified, amplified. The longer you stay in student ministries, the probably more significant that this is going to be, that their capacity to sit down with a page of Scripture and actually take it in, you have to very acutely lead them into the way that they're going to read the text. We'll talk about how to do that. All right, be faster, be better. A couple thoughts. You read the passage. The most evil, toxic thing in this church, if there's something evil and toxic in this church, it's this God-forsaken thing that's taken root, where people have the audacity to preach the Bible and let other people be the ones that actually read the Bible. That is the craziest thing I have ever heard in my entire life. That is the craziest thing I've ever heard. You got dealt this text that you spent weeks praying about, thinking about the flow and the thought and the pathos and the emotion, and you have the insanity, when it comes time to read those verses, to pick on an illiterate 14-year-old boy who has watched so much porn that he doesn't feel anything anymore, to be the one to read the passage and say, to live is Christ, to die is gain. The craziest, it is the most pathological thing I have ever heard. It's psychotic. It is psychotic. The Bible drips with emotion and intrigue and humor and pathos and intensity. And the way that you read the passage can do 50% of your job as a teacher. Because when you understand those things, the way you enunciate, the way you pause, the way you reread things and draw on humor, you can do half. Part of the reason why sometimes it feels like people take way longer than it should to exposit, to work through four or five verses, is because they're not just reading the verses well. If you read the verses yourself and you make some commentary and you point out the key ideas and you add the emotional inflection, you can do so much of this as you go. Drag them into the words, kicking and screaming. It should look like this. Dragging them, ripping them into the words that are on the page because they're not listening. They're not listening. They're not reading. They're not. You have to force them into thinking about the specific words. We're going to talk about all these. We're going to go through some examples and talk about these. Use what I'm going to call springboard words. In any passage, there are specific chunks of words that you're going to want to point their attention to and that you're going to use as your springboard into the ideas. This is a key notion because what this is going to build for your students, it's going to cement the understanding that the things that the preacher guy is saying, he didn't just come up with those out of nowhere, but this is what's going to grow their sense that God is the one that's commanding me to do these things, that wants these things in my life. The key here is the skill of pulling your students back to key specific words and phrases and launching yourself into your major points based on those. Avoid what I'm going to call boredom traps. When people ask me for feedback and they send me outlines, this is basically the best way I could put it. I'll look at their outline and oftentimes I can see a section of it and say, this is what I would call a boredom trap, where based on what you've wrote, the amount of time it looks like you're going to spend on these two verses and the points you're going to make, I know that no one's going to be listening. This is going to take you 6 minutes to do and it's going to be utterly worthless. Wait your expositing time on the most important ideas in the text. We're going to talk about how to do that as well. We're going to come back to these. All right, let's work through an example. Philippians 1. Paul, yes, and I'll continue to rejoice, for I know that through your prayers and God's provision of the Spirit of Jesus Christ and what has happened to me will turn out for my deliverance. I eagerly expect and hope that I will no way be ashamed, but will have sufficient courage so that now, as always, Christ will be exalted in my body, for whether by life or death, for to me, to live is Christ and die is gain. Okay, so you're preaching this text to your students. The first idea we talked about, you do the reading. Yeah, you're the one that studied this passage. You study it and you realize, you know, the last time I preached this passage, I had this thought as I was studying it. You think of Paul saying, yeah, to live is Christ, to die is gain. It's catchy, it sticks with you, it feels like, to live is Christ and die is gain. But I don't actually think that that's it. I think that the emotion more at this moment for Paul, it's more like a shrug, but like a badass shrug. Like he gets to this point and what Paul is describing in this passage is just a supreme confidence in the sovereignty of God and that God has him. It's all going to turn out for my deliverance. I mean, in my body, whether by life or death, Christ is going to be exalted. He's pointing to the anchors in his mind that just root him down in God's got me, I'm with him, and no matter what happens, if I'm offering myself up to God, he's going to be glorified, he's going to be honored, and so to live is Christ, to die is gain. It's just a sense of like give me your best shot. It doesn't matter what it is. To live is Christ, to die is gain. I'm good. I'm with God. But like you have that insight into the passage of this attitude that Paul has here of how is it that he's able to rejoice? All these things, he has it because he's got this bone deep that, this world's going to be uncertain, but no matter how this breaks for me, I'm good because I'm with God. Either way, yeah, this is why you do the reading. Because you can emphasize, you can draw on these ideas. You can read it in such a way that when you get to this verse, they're like, yeah, to live is Christ, to die is gain. Drag them into the words. Here's what it might look like in this passage. Okay, so you read these verses with them. How do I get them to notice some specific words that draw us to the key ideas? Here's one of the ways I might do it. So I would read these verses, and then I would say, all right, so what's one of the big things that we notice as we read this text? We notice that Paul is largely describing his emotions and his attitudes in this situation. And then I would hold my Bible up to my face like I'm blind. And I'm showing them, look what I'm doing right now. I'm rereading these verses, and we're all going to do this together. I'll say stuff like, so let's look back in the text, and I'll point at it. I'll punch my Bible. Let's all look back, and I'll hold it up like I'm blind. I'll signal like, everybody in this room right now, we're gonna look back at these verses. So what do we notice about Paul's emotions and his attitude? Rejoicing, eagerly expecting and hoping, and no, he's not going to be ashamed. Courage, exaltation. Joy, courage, exaltation, no shame, expectation, hope. These are the attitudes, the feelings that Paul is exuding in this section, and yet what is the context? What's on his mind? Death. His potential, imminent, impending death. The tension that we talked about the first week. This is probably the way I would approach this teaching is in the first couple of minutes, I would draw them into this apparent contradiction in Paul's situation and what seems to be on his mind, which is he could die here. And the way that he's feeling in this situation, which is I'm rejoicing, exaltation, hope, expectation. Yeah, I would bring out this tension. Do you see this difference in what Paul's feeling and his actual situation? By pointing out the specific words and going back and reading just a couple of them. See, it doesn't work as well if I go back and just read the whole section. You have to chunk it up. You have to break it down. If you want more on this, I would recommend Greg Scharf, his book, Let the Earth Hear His Voice. He's got a chapter where he just talks about breaking down the component parts of a passage and figuring out what are the key words, what are the emotional words, what are the antithetical words, what are the modes of speech that they use here. Yeah, I draw them back into specific words to start to frame the way that we're going to understand the text. Let the earth hear his voice, Greg Scharf. Yeah, excellent. Unbelievable book. Okay, avoid boredom traps. So a couple of things I think where you could, if I'm preaching through this passage, stuff that I would not spend a lot of time on, but I think that you could. Okay, you go up to these verses. I know that through your prayers and God's provision of the Spirit, what has happened will turn out for my deliverance. It's kind of funky that these are the two things that Paul brings up. It's through their prayers, the provision of the Spirit, that everything's going to turn out for his deliverance. Why does he pick these things? In a college cell group, I love this question. Love it. I think it's phenomenal. You could skip over this. So sometimes Paul will do stuff he'll introduce cause and effect, and the cause doesn't seem to cause the effect. But when Paul does this, it's always so intriguing. And in this, there's the really intriguing proposition of just how much Paul seems to value the intercessory prayers of the church. That's excellent. In a college cell group meeting, I'm all over that, munching that up. I think that's fascinating. Hell no. In a student teaching, it's the kind of thing that I know that through your prayers and God's provision of the Spirit of Christ, it's all going to turn out for my deliverance. Zip. No need. I'm going to blow through this. I'm going to blow past it. I don't think it adds. I don't think it builds to the main ideas that I'm causing. I'm not derailing their understanding of the text. I hope that further on in discipleship, they're going to have a robust discussion about intercessory prayer. I'm not trying to do that in my passage. I eagerly expect and hope that I will in no way be ashamed, but will have sufficient courage. Hope, courage. What does he mean? That he's going to have sufficient courage in this situation. Where's that come from? What are the Greek words for hope? Hell no. Discussion of Paul's setup as a prisoner. Is he about to die? You know, he ends up not dying this time. Like, how close is he to dying? Is he on house? Like, talking for a long time about Paul's situation. You know, Paul, he's in prison in Rome. He might die, but he's probably not going to die. He ends up dying later. Just say, Paul knows that he might die soon. That's all you have to say. Yeah. It's finding ways to trim some ideas in the text that they're there, they exist, but in a teaching for students, I need to be able to move with more pace through this. I don't need to delve into every possible rabbit trail that could pop up in this passage. I'm certainly not going to ask a discussion question. So this would be where so often someone will get to one of these ideas and they'll pause and they'll ask a discussion question just because they're like, well, I'm already 6 minutes into my teaching, so I've got to ask a discussion question, otherwise I'm doing a bad job. No. I want to direct their eyes to the most important ideas. I need to be able to move with pace through stuff that isn't as important. If I need to say something, I'm going to say something real fast so that they understand the thought flow, and that's it. Use springboard words into the points that I'm trying to make in this passage. I'm making my points about Paul's, the confidence, the attitude that he has here. I'm going to point them back to some key words. We see Paul, rejoicing with this confident knowledge. He's eagerly expecting and hoping. What? What's happening? It's going to turn out. It will turn out for my deliverance. Christ will be exalted in my body. My springboard words here in this passage are, as I see them, is will turn out for my deliverance and will be exalted. Everything else in Paul's life is chaos and uncertain, but the two things he knows is that God has my back and that God is going to be glorified, and nothing could ever change that. And when I make these points, I'm going to get them to reread those words, and I'm going to point them to see, do you see this robust, incredible attitude that Paul has here towards the Lord? And I'm going to wait my time. I'm going to wait my time. It's an incredible verse. Therefore, I'm going to hunker down on this verse. It sticks with people for a while. To live is Christ and to die is gain. How is it that Paul has this thought? How does he have this perspective? What's the anchor for this shocking level of confidence in God's sovereignty? Where will I end up in my faith if I don't find that kind of an anchor? What can I start doing? Application to cultivate this measure of confidence. Paul's not a superhero. He's not inaccessible. There have to be actions. There has to be a bedrock in the faith that leads to the ability to say, if I live, I'm going to keep going with God, and we're going to do some cool stuff together. And if I die, I'm with God, and that's great. Yeah. Waiting my time so that I'm going to spend, if I'm teaching on this passage to a group of students, I would probably hope to spend maybe 5 or 6 minutes talking my way through the whole passage. It's a pretty short block of verses. This will change. Sometimes you get dealt a whole chapter of narrative, and you're going to teach the passage by doing a lot more reading and bringing a lot more of your thoughts as you go. I think this is an example, as many times in the epistles, where for a group of students, as I move through the passage, I'm going to go pretty fast. I'm going to help them to see the thought flow. I'm going to ignore rabbit trails. I'm not going to answer every question that could come up. If a student reads a question, maybe there's a slight apparent contradiction. It's not obvious. It's not in your face, whatever. If a student asks a question at the end of the teaching, well, what about this? We didn't talk about that. That's phenomenal. That's great. I'm fine with that. Then I'm going to have a discussion with them. They're actually listening. I don't need to answer every conceivable question that comes up for my students. So often after, I'll hear someone teach a block of scripture to students, and I can tell you've covered each, like every screen wipe that Roch does where it goes to a new screen of 8 different interesting points. You've hit all of those in a shockingly worse way, but you've done it still. And congratulations, but it took you, 30 minutes to do, and now you have to apply this teaching, and they're gone. You don't have to do that. I think increasingly with our students, we do want them to build out a robust, complete biblical knowledge, ability to pull scripture apart. We're going to do that a lot in discipleship. In your Bible teachings, you don't have to answer every question. You don't have to cover the entire thing. You have to help them to see the thought flow, and you have to get to the most important ideas. I've got more time than I expected. Anybody have thoughts on that or questions about progressing through the text? I'll try to leave you guys some thoughts at the end. Yes. Yeah. Yeah, and I think that can help for catching some of these boredom traps. If you see that, like, me explaining this apparent tension in the text is going to take, if I practice my teaching, for instance, and I'm 6-8 minutes into doing this, I start to catch, okay, I'm in one of these traps. Even if this is an intriguing or difficult question, it's going to be hard for my students to still be with me. Yeah, I think that's good. Yep. Yeah.
I'm in a bullet point, like, summarize it, essentially. Here,
yes.
Like, assuming, like, you're not going to understand it if I read it. Now I'm going to explain it to you, like,
you're yeah.
And instead of, like, what you're doing here, like, keep the passage there and point at it, underline it, do whatever. Keep them actually looking at it in the text and
Yeah.
You're not just like, here it is, okay, now I'm going to just rephrase this in two sentences.
And it's, where's the weight? Where's the power? We have to maintain this conviction that God can only change them if they understand that God is the one that's speaking to them. Not my paraphrase of what the text said, but what it actually said. How many of you guys do PowerPoint in your teachings and student groups? Just, yeah, that's good to know. That's interesting. Yeah, yep.
Mm-hmm. And I think that could guide, like, if you have an idea like that, that could guide some of those, like, application points of, like, why don't I just ask them to do things?
Yeah.
I just like that. That was really helpful. But, yeah, that's a good question. It's like, what would be an ideal scenario, like, of my students taking action afterwards?
Yeah, and that's, if I had a critique of a lot of application I hear, I think that people are shooting far too low and what they think their students are capable of. Yeah, why not take enough time where I sit with the text and just kind of dream, if God could do this in my student's life, what could it be? And now, how can I use sharp, specific words to try to help them to see, this is at least an opportunity, you could try this. Love that, that's great, yeah. 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 Yeah, that's good. And so often it's like, I do think that what the text is doing is trying to move people along the change model. And so what the text wants from them is thoughts. Thought experiments and thought exercises. I think it's just, I have to convert that into a thing that they do to think those thoughts. Otherwise, they won't think those thoughts. And I don't necessarily know that that's true with an older audience. I think you could maybe tell a college audience, I think God wants you to do, I think what he wants is for you to dwell on these things. I think that this week you should carve out some time in your God to just think about this stuff. Instead, with students, one way is increase specificity. I would point to one of the words in the, God is saying he wants us to dwell on his sovereignty. And I ask him, why don't you, when you talk to God this week, why don't you just write down a couple of ways you've noticed times that God had your back, where he was taking care of you. And I'm directing them to do a thought experiment to think, but I'm trying to make it more concrete. We talked about sharing stories or something. Those are ways that you're getting them to do the thinking part of it, but you're making it actionable. So like with sex, choosing God's view of sex, they ultimately just have to kick that over in their head. Am I going to listen to God about this? But can I get them into one of those thought experiments? Here's how someone else experienced this. Now we're talking about it. Yeah, it's just trying to take it one degree of specificity over to where they can actually try something or do something. I've done before with my group, like, if it is, I want them to think about something. I'm like, I'm going to send you guys a couple of verses after the teaching, and why don't you think about this question tomorrow when you get some time with God, and then we could talk about it. And I've had guys actually do that. They'll do a little bit of homework and come back, and we'll talk about the verse I wanted them to ruminate on. So those are a couple ideas, but it's giving some more structure to them doing the change model in their head, I guess is the thought. All right, got a couple thoughts on discipleship. We'll leave a little more time for questions if you guys have them. Okay, just as I've been reading through some of this material on teaching and learning for students, here's a couple of opinions I think I'm forming at this point about how I would approach discipleship. Here's basically one of them. When it comes to Bible teachings, I am increasingly of the opinion that a good Bible teaching for students should really not look like discipleship, in the sense that I'm not going to dig so far into the weeds. I'm not going to do everything that's happening in the passage. I'm going to try to make the overall meaning of the text clear, and I'm going to try to do a couple things well, and I'm going to give them some application ideas. I actually think with discipleship, an error that I think people can make is they sit down to study with a student and kind of basically give them a Bible teaching or talk through a Bible text together. I actually think that for some of our students, they're going to do a little better if we are more goal-oriented in what we're covering in our discipleship. I actually think in some ways it might help our students if discipleship looked a little more like school or sports. I'll point out how I think this means, whatever. I do think it should be short, the block of study. I think it should be pretty short. I mean, if I was working with middle school guys, it would probably be 15 minutes. With high school guys, maybe 20, especially if they've got a teaching coming later that night, maybe 20 minutes, 25 on the high end, but I really wouldn't do more than that. I would try to just deal with a small chunk of ideas a week. And that's just out of my reading on how their pool of resources and how I do not think that if you sit down one-on-one that a 45-minute session is going to go that well. I think that shorter choices of what you're studying would be good. And what I mean by this is I don't think that it's necessarily the best idea to go through entire books of the Bible or entire spiritual books with a student. And what I mean by that is almost always to do that, I'm going to have to spend, if they meet with you like 3 or 4 weeks of the month, it's probably pretty good with a high school disciple. You'd feel good about that. It's going to take you half a year to finish any given study with a high school disciple. I think for a lot of them, this is going to get boring. I think for a lot of them, they're going to have a hard time still understanding why they're studying the thing. Instead, I would actually suggest being a little more topical in the way that you would approach discipleship. And this is informed by... I cut the studies for time. We actually probably had time, but one of the big ideas in pedagogy right now is that you need to increase front-ending your goals for learning to students. That students do a lot better when they know at the outset, at the end of learning this thing, this is what I'm going to be able to do. This is how I'm going to increase. Letting them know in advance, this is where we're trying to get at the end of this study, helps people to lock in and actually engage with the material. It's what works, in school. If you actually lock in and learn this, you're going to be able to do that. You could do this someday. In sports, if you lock in and learn this skill, you could be able to do this someday. I think it's the same. Like, in this study, we're going to try to lock in and learn these things about God or these things about serving Him. And at the end, you're going to be better at blank. There's some examples. You do a 6-week study on body life, where you pull different passages each time. And every week you pick a way that you're both gonna live that out that night at home church. And then you come back the next week, and in discipleship, we're gonna talk about, all right, how do we do a bearing with one another in love when we were at home church tonight? What did you do? How did that play out? Whatever application you discussed in your time, you talk about it. And the goal is at the front, we want to learn how to be, if in the body of Christ, I'm the kidney or I'm the liver. I want to be a damn good liver, and 6 weeks from now, I want to be a better liver than I am right now. And so, a specific study with a goal where they may actually have buy-in and say, yeah, I think I want that. 4-week study on predictive prophecy. And the goal is that by the end of this month, I'm going to mention something I'm learning to a friend that's not a believer. Man, I just read this crazy thing the other day. Shocking. I couldn't believe that the Bible actually says this. Or rather than, I might not read a 20-chapter evidence book. Like, I think Evidence Unseen is great for students. I actually think it's really good. I wouldn't read the whole thing. Instead, I might pick 6 or 7 chapters and say, in these 7 weeks, we're going to pray every week. We're going to talk, can you find a non-believing friend that you can share some of the stuff we're talking about with? Spend 5 weeks. You're trying to help a student that's had a tough life, some emotional stability. We're going to read a psalm each week. We're going to ask these same questions every time we do it. What emotions does it seem like the psalmist is bringing to God? And how do God's truths seem to filter down into those emotions? I found that high school students tend to do really well, actually, when there's a little bit of structure. Like, if I do a study like this and I make a doc, and we have it sitting there on the table next to us, we read the passage, we type out each week these questions. And the point is, they can see over time, I'm actually adding skills, I'm growing. In part, what I'm saying is, I think in the teaching space with students, sometimes we're trying to do too much discipleship, and we're boring as hell. And I think in the discipleship space with students, we're trying to do too much counseling and too much teaching, and we should actually communicate to our students, I want you to become a biblical leader someday. I want to help you make some gains in your faith and your Christian service, and we're going to be a little more focused about how we get there. I actually think they're going to dial into your time more, and they might actually apply some of the things a lot more if you start trying that. Spending some time before you meet with your disciples, praying about what are we covering today and what's the application that I'm going to give you, again, based on the principles that we described earlier. Always, what are we going to do tonight based on what we just read? What are we going to do on Sunday when we get to home church on Sunday? What are we going to do? And then when I pick them up for home church that day, I'm going to remind them, hey, what do we talk about? And then we'll pray for it on the ride to home church. What do we talk about? What are we going to try at home church tonight? Bringing some of that application in mind into discipleship. And finally, I think finding some ways to communicate to your students that this is the part of your relationship that you really care about the most. That your hope, your goal for them is that in a couple of years, they're gonna know a lot more about God. They're gonna be way more equipped to teach the Bible to someone, to help someone understand it, to serve people, to love people. And I think there's little ways that you can do this with students of just like when you sit down to do your study to convey excitement. You do this 5 or 6 week study on prophecy and you build out this doc with your student on here's what we understand and here's what we can do. And as you do, you know, you stack it up and by the end you're like, man, yeah, now we've got some stuff. You've got some ammunition. There's some bullets in the chamber, man. And before you're a wimpy. If someone poked at you with questions about the Bible, you would have folded. But now look at this. You've got boom, 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 boom. Hell yeah. You're ready. Now you're not so scared. You can go out there and you've got some stuff. You're not going to be on your back foot. Conveying that you care and you're excited about them making gains in their faith. Yeah. You can do this. You might say to yourself, I don't know, I'm not sure about capacity. You're talking about these things are conceivable for a 17-year-old, affluent, good family, you know, Worthington girl. She could do this. Dude, I got on to thinking about some of this stuff because a guy in my home church started with his, going into eighth grade, guys that go to Harambe, one of them from really difficult background. He started doing with them their senior year. They were going to read the whole New Testament. And he made notebooks for them where he wrote 5 or 6 questions they were going to ask with each book of the Bible. And they're memorizing a verse out of each one, and they're crushing it. They've got like 10. And at the end of it, he's going to take one of them to a basketball game. He's getting the other one a skateboard. And they're jacked about this study that they're doing. They're pumped. They're coming into his time excited. And they're 13-year-old guys from unchurched backgrounds. You can do what that pinged me in on, and what is backed up by some of the research is they react well when you have some goals, you communicate some belief in them. And so I think rather than have my discipleship time look like lengthy, extensive counseling or like me kind of preaching a text to them, try to find ways to make it clear. There's a specific skill or understanding about God I want you to have at the end of this shorter section. That's what I'm trying to do at this point with high school disciples. All right, that's what I got. Leave a little bit of time if you guys have other thoughts or questions. We can talk about that for a few minutes. I wanted to talk about feedback a little. I made a feedback sheet based on some of the stuff we've talked about that I like better than some of our other homiletic stuff for students that I will send out to you guys. I just published a post-class assignment. If you want to do it, you can. I would strongly encourage you to. It's a practice teaching that asks a number of the big questions that we've worked through in class. If you go through it and submit it, I'll give you some feedback, and I think it'd be a good exercise, but that's posted for you. And I'll share like that feedback sheet and stuff with you. All right, any other thoughts or questions before we wrap up here?
I got one.
Yeah.
At what point, so you talked about the like timeline of preparing your teaching, like this now do this. Do you prepare that completely before you start working on your teaching, or do you like get an idea of what you're going through?
The way that I do my CTs, for instance, and you'd have to adapt this. I'm of the opinion that the best Bible teaching happens when you leave yourself a lot of unstructured rumination time. So for when we pick a new CT series, I carve out a day where I read through the whole book that I'm going to be preaching, and I just sketch out for each of the passages, here's a thought on what the main tension could be. Here's a thought on the main idea, and here's a thought on the main application. And sometimes I'm wrong. I go back and study the text, and I'm like, oh, that's not it. That's deer wrestling. But other times, really what it does for me is I'll have passages just kind of kicking over in my head. I'm driving, and for like weeks or a couple months, it's just kind of simmering on the back burner, like what could be the thing. That helps me. And in fact, the more that I do that, the more that like I can bang out making a teaching fast if I've actually been ruminating on it. And so for like high school, college, home church, I'll do this where like 2 weeks ahead of time, I'll just sit with the text and I'll read. And when I'm driving, you know, on the toilet, 2 weeks, I'm thinking, this passage I'm going to teach, that's the times. That's when and then I sit down and actually make the teaching, and it's like, it feels like a lot of the ideas have already fleshed out. That's probably my most immediate practical suggestion is we're all busy, we're all doing a lot, and so a lot of us feel this sense of guilt. I don't have, you know, 8 hours to put into this teaching. Like, I'm busy. If you just slide the work up and start thinking about the passage a lot earlier, you might sit down and in 45 minutes knock out the teaching. Because some of the stuff that just takes a while to settle into your heart and the vision, the dream for your students, like when you sit down and you just got off work and you're hyped up on coffee, like it's hard to just like crank out of your brain that vision. But if you leave the Holy Spirit sometimes, that's what's been working for me. So, yeah. Yeah.
I feel like sometimes the boarding traps and teachings are like right before the session, and then someone will like shoot a discussion and everyone's lost what the heck they're talking about.
Yeah.
I
want a discussion question to feel like the bottom of a toilet bowl. And so when I am leading to a discussion, I'm going to swirl for a long time. This is the way that I've been approaching discussion. We read through a couple verses, and I say, so I think there's an intriguing idea here, and I want to talk about it with you. Now I've cued the little dogs just heard a rabbit in the woods, and their ears perk up. Oh God, he's going to make me talk. And then I'll rephrase, what's the intriguing idea that I want to talk about in the passage? And then I'll ask my question one way, and this is like, if you line me up, if you made me teach a homiletics class right now, I might get shot for some of my opinions. But I do craft discussion questions. The way that I like to ask them is I like to ask three bad versions of the question first before I land on a decent version. And the reason I like this is because it gives people a while for their brains to start to chew on the thing before we actually get to what I'm asking. And I honestly, I'm kind of cueing people into these are some of the different ways I could think about asking this, but here's the thing. So it's like, so yeah, maybe what do we think about this? And so I guess what I'm really getting at is, well, maybe we could talk about this. And I talk about that some more. I'm like, oh, no, actually, like, here's what I mean. What do you think about blah, blah, blah? Or what can we do with blah, blah, blah? And at that point, it's been 45 seconds or a minute. And the whole time, like, as soon as I talked about the intriguing idea or I asked my question the first time, they got what we were going to talk about. But that whole time, I'm just giving their brains more energy, more room to simmer on what we're going to talk about. And by the time we're at the bottom of the toilet bowl, it's painstakingly clear. Whatever. That's the way I'm doing it right now. I like it. It seems like it's been going a lot better. Usually by the end of that 45, 60 seconds, you got a bunch of hands in the air. So, yeah. Sure. Yeah.
It's harder for them. So I was just kind of curious, like, do all these things you are teaching, do you do those at your college home church teaching, or are there some things you do differently?
My college home church teachings definitely look a lot different.
Yeah.
I routinely will teach 55 minutes or an hour, and I think they go well. I will delve into minutiae in the passage. I think 5 years from now, that won't be true. Something, they will still be more robust and longer, but I think that people are going to wake up to some of this stuff in college in 5 years and be behind the eight ball. So I do think that that's true. I think the biggest things that cross over and apply immediately are developing a more, is the sticky ideas, a punch in my teaching and more actionable thoughts. I think that's my two biggest critiques of college teachings I hear, is that they're not giving a clear enough thing for people to grab onto and do something with. The people paying attention part, long enough to learn, that works itself out a lot better. Yeah. The most toxic, evil thing about our church. Yes. Yeah.
I was thinking about your point on discipleship and how we should maybe not just do an entire book or different things. And I actually am studying with like a 19-year-old guy, and I feel like I've kind of stumbled into that, of like different things have kind of come up in his life or things.
Sure.
Like,
yeah.
Or it's like a lot of it's not even applicable at different times. And so really trying to hit that sweet spot. And I feel like I've done that the last few weeks, where it's
nice.
Like, oh, this is really relevant for his life right now. Like, you just read the distance paper that Doug wrote.
Great.
It's like awesome.
Yeah.
And there were things coming up that he was like, I'm really feeling this and taking action on it. But if we would have just kept reading the book or like going through
my
life on evangelism, that wouldn't have been relevant. You know?
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's really good. And even it's just like if you do a little bit of homework and you say, like, I've got this guy, he really needs to read Untangling right now. I can probably pick 7 chapters that are going to do the job instead of the whole thing. Yeah, it's good thoughts. Anything else? Yeah. PowerPoint and teachings. I don't do it. I have done it in my high school home church teachings, but I don't. I dislike losing the fireside chat feel. I don't like that. You could really easily persuade me that they're a lot better for holding people's attention and being a little more clear. I think you could sell me on that pretty fast. So I don't have a formed opinion. I'm not doing it yet, because honestly, with the discussion question, something that I have been trying to foster in my home church teachings is an increased sense of, like, I'm finding that students are doing a lot better with my teachings when the stuff in the thought reading I gave you guys about trying to make sure your outline is really behind the scenes so it doesn't feel like we're just sitting down for school time. I'm really, really trying to have that in my teachings right now. I want it to kind of feel like I just dropped in out of the blue and here's this Bible passage and I guess let's read it together. I'm trying to make my jokes less polished, my question, like I want it to just feel like we're in this together looking into the text, and that's actually been going pretty well. I think a PowerPoint does a little bit of the opposite of that. It's a little more like school. But I don't. I'm not married to that. I think there actually probably are a lot of benefits of images, something for them to look at, something to hold their attention. PowerPoint definitely does a lot for funneling your ideas and making them more clear. So, yeah, I have nothing helpful to add. It's good. All right, Brad. Right.
It can be pretty easy for us to maybe teach to our older students, and if it goes over the head of the younger students or vice versa, where older students might be bored. You mentioned a little bit about that earlier, but you kind of talked about how it comes out.
Yeah, I think that that's where the parts of the teaching that are appropriate to vary as much as I can, like application or antithesis, I'm going to. I do think that we should have a sense that we are communicating a sense of belief in our students that this might be hard, but I think you can get this. I think we have to preserve that. If you're in a home church where there's really disparate abilities of some students and others, this is where I really like the idea right now of doing some lecturing and then splitting the students up for some discussion groups, where you can get a little more specific and talk about a little more concrete, difficult ideas. If I had a high school guys cell group where those things were very different, I might do a teaching where I come up with an outline of some questions that we're going to ask in our own groups, and we're going to come back and talk together. I think there might be things like that. You could try to get some varied content to different students or different levels of discussion going. Yeah. For your students that have a harder comprehension time, I think that some of that, I don't think that you need to water down all the ways you're expositing the passage. I do think that if you are really good with your punch and with your application, they're going to be there for the most important ideas they need to understand anyway. So it's almost more less an ability level, especially attending to the fact that a non-believer can look into this and see stuff. Yeah. Yeah. I focused more on epistles because my observation is in this fellowship, we seem to be really good at teaching at narrative. When my high school groups do narrative, people tend to rock their teachings because frankly, it's just so much easier. You just have to get yourself the hell out of the way and tell the story well. If you want resources on that, Scott's homiletic stuff on preaching narrative is it an XSI? It's a billion times better than anything I could ever say, so you should just listen to that. That's why I angled this, because frankly, I think it is so much easier. Part of what that informs is I would, if I'm looking at a whole year with my high school group, I would probably want to spend 50% of the time in narrative, because it's easier for them to grab. And I would want to spend 50% in epistles because the application is a lot more pointed. The ability to apply it really specifically and well is a lot more pointed. Narrative is faith stuff. It's faith stuff by and large. It's a lot harder to get into the weeds. So a lot of these principles are a lot more difficult with the epistles, which is why we spend more time thinking about them. Yeah. Almost more than anything, the point that I talked about earlier of spending more time on your teaching series and making the right chunks of text, being able to skip chunks of text and summarize, even in narrative. We skip four chapters because you would hate them. Here's what happened. That's fine. If John Stott rises from the grave and tries to kill you, I'm sorry, but you're fine. All right, let's just pray, and thanks for coming, guys. Appreciate it. Yeah, thanks, Lord, that we're speaking from your love, and pray for all these guys here that you would help them to have vision and joy and excitement for the teaching ministry that you've given them, God. This is just the most, you know, it's one of the most joyful, beautiful things that we get to do in this life, to speak your word. Just help us to approach our next couple of teachings with joy and gratitude that we get to do this, and not with fear or apprehension about getting all the details right. Amen. If you guys have more questions or thoughts, or if you want feedback on a teaching, I will look at an outline and give you feedback. You can email me a teaching anytime. It's my favorite thing to do, so do it whenever. I don't care.